Here it comes, the latest people, trends, and news on sustainable living in and around our corner of the country. Down to Earth with Mrs. Green, Spotlight on the Southwest. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. It is Mrs. Green, and you are listening to Down to Earth with me, Spotlight on the Southwest. Thanks so much for joining us. And I'm telling you, get ready for another fun, informative show about a topic that is everybody's favorite topic, pretty much, food. We would like to thank the University of Arizona for being a sponsor of the show and for their ongoing support of Mrs. Green's World Mission. We appreciate them. We're proud that we have them as a partner, and we're so excited about all the great work that they're doing globally to make a difference for the planet. And now please join me in welcoming our guest. Her name is Dr. Maribel Alvarez, and I'm going to say that because I love it and I hope that sounds good. She is an associate research professor at the School of Anthropology, an associate research social scientist at the Southwest Center, and program director for Southwest Folklife Alliance, a parent company of Tucson Meet Yourself. And that is a lot. She is going to be a guest lecturer for the Downtown Lecture Series, which starts on October 15th at the Fox Theater. And this series is all about food. The series is free. It's usually standing room only so far. I'm sure there's precedent for that. So if you're planning to go, I strongly suggest and advise that you get there before 6:30 or you'll end up in the overflow auditorium at Tucson Electric Power, and you'll want to be there. And we'll talk a lot about what you're going to do. Welcome so much and thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
So let's start with the most clever title I may have ever seen on my show, and I'm barely kidding. Instead of We Are What We Eat, the title of the series that you're going to present on is We Eat What We Are. And it's not just a clever title, it gives you pause, and it made me stop and think. So tell me how you came up with it and what you mean by that.
Actually, a fellow folklorist had mentioned it in something I was reading it. At one point, an article on food waste and culture, and this folklorist commented that should be the logical way in which we should really think about food, not so much the conventional one that we always hear, that we are what we eat, which is really an admonition of eating right. And if you eat healthy food, you're a healthy person. If you're indulging your passions and your lower instincts of fast food and things like that, then you are going to be reflecting that in your body and in your level of energy. This was a flip on that tried to emphasize culture. Really, a lot of what we consider edible, tasteful, has to do with ideas, symbols, values, things that sometimes we're not even aware of because that's how culture functions. It's pretty much under the radar for us most of the time.
And when I was doing the research for this show, I did think a lot about that. We just kind of eat, and yet when I read about all of the work you're doing, almost every single thing we do, for holidays, for birth, for death, everything. I mean, Labor Day, 4th of July, every celebration, without question, is all focused on food and gathering and eating.
And that's one of the ways in which we folklorists think about tradition, as something that is consistent. It's repetitive, but it's also different in each time that it is performed. And I tell my students, think about me going and joining suddenly your Thanksgiving dinner.
Right.
You know what? Even though it is Thanksgiving and we all know supposedly what it is about, you'll have to probably translate for me how is it that your family does it. Because your family has a culture as a family that then imposes a little bit of a distinct flavor, a distinct performance on Thanksgiving than my family or somebody else's family. And when you think about that, it's such a simple concept, but at the same time, it tells you something really profound about culture, and that is that it's multi-layered, and that it's not just one thing. I think the times when we were able to use single adjective to describe whole cultures as those old 1950s black and white documentaries that they showed in to kids
in
school.
That says Ozzie and Harriet or whatever.
Yeah.
Yes.
I always say they had that voice that says, the Navajo races early in the morning and gazes upon the horizon. I think that we all now know that culture is more complicated than just a simple accumulation of traits that are fixed and permanent. It's always performed, and food is the perfect artifact to mobilize towards that end.
And for the way that a lot of us were raised, like in my family, it was, there's always room at our table for one other person. I mean, all of those social values, if I may. Now, what about, and Thanksgiving's a perfect example, because when you talk about that, even mixing cultures, and by I mean when people get married, well, I like my mother's stuffing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but my mother makes it this way, and whose stuffing are we going to make? It goes that deep. What stuffing are we going to have, your mother's or my mother's?
Well, absolutely, and that's so interesting because demographically, more and more Americans are of mixed races and ethnicities, and people are now becoming more comfortable with being hybrid and creating new American ways of being at the kitchen, at the table, that is not just limited by one single definition of Greekness or Italianness or Mexicanness. People are really borrowing pretty freely across the culinary landscape to make home something. But on the other hand, what is surprising to me and to those who study food is how enduring food remains as the marker of
the defining
identity.
Yes. So tell me about it. In the writings, it also said, you said, our everyday meals tell a story about us. So what kind of story do they tell? Well, does my story tell about me?
Absolutely. I have a wonderful friend who grew up in Phoenix, Arizona. He's in his late 20s. And grew up in Phoenix, Arizona, from parents who came from India, Bengali family. As an American teenager, he rebelled against a lot of his parents' mores and ideas about India. Never went to India, hated him every time that they forced him to go to India. Embrace American culture, goes to the university, speaks English, of course, this is his language, is master American teenager. Yet, I go to his house, and what does he serve? Indian food.
There you go.
Bengali food
that
traditions,
stays.
Right? Because it is the residual element of culture that is pretty hard. And I think that a lot of it has to do with the fact that in a lot of ways we associate it deeply with the love of family as babies. It begins
comfort.
Right there.
There's something to the word comfort food
yes.
when we start out. I mean, the happiest memories in my lifetime were all around celebrations where family was gathered at the table. No question about it.
And that's where you go when you are an adult and you probably moved away from your old ethnic or religious beliefs and you are out in the world. You go there to that place. And usually it's also an arena where you both can be traditional but innovative, right? You can be serving traditional Mexican food in your home, and you still can be very involved with contemporary things that do not put you in any stereotype box as that ethnicity. I think that's a freedom that food brings us that allows for that kind of innovation.
And I want to ask you this. I never play stump the guest, but I've never, ever, ever been able to ask anybody this question. So I was raised in an Irish family, Irish many times removed, a diluted Irish family. And every St. Patrick's Day, we had corned beef and cabbage. Well, then I was watching a Brad Pitt movie, and he said, that's not an Irish meal. Nobody eats corned beef and cabbage on St. Patrick's Day in Ireland. How do those things get how does that tradition, it was so, I was like devastated. I mean, what do you mean? That's what every Irish American eats on St. Patrick's Day. So how does that tradition get a little mixed? Does it come over on the boat and somebody decided they were going to cook it? How does that happen? You know, you're the historian about that.
The way that scholars have noted the pattern is that migration, it moves in different waves. First, there is a period of distance from the original country in the effort to try to retain a sense of home,
right,
informed by nostalgia. And sometimes, even more than that, sometimes because the first immigrants in the United States really came and remained in their ethnic enclaves for a long time. If you were Italian, you really needed independent on other Italians to guide you and
right,
help you
right,
navigate both the language and how to get by in the world, and that happened with the Greeks and the Jewish community and the Polish community. So the first is sort of like there's that separation and the nostalgia for the food, for home. Then the enclaves that form the ability to form social groups around which you can share that food, and also the supplies. How are you going to get the ingredients and the purveyors of those particular foodstuff that you need for your kitchen? So it becomes like that. And then as time goes on, of course, a lot of those varieties of foods become Americanized.
Right.
But in the process of doing that, we end up reaffirming and inventing new modes of national alliances that were not even really true back home.
Right, we're creating our own memories, starting to make them all. That makes so much sense.
Absolutely, a form of attachment that is heightened here that is very different from the original country. And at the same time, sometimes you find that the original countries, the countries of origin, have spent so much time ideologically and politically shaping what is the national cuisine that people also rebel against that. For example, you have in France, in England, in a lot of countries, a real effort to codify pretty clearly what is Frenchness.
No kidding.
What is appropriate French
eating? That's a perfect example.
Right?
The French are very, very particular
very
about
particular
that branding.
About it. And the state sometimes invests a lot of energy into declaring national dishes, national things that we eat as French, things that we don't eat. So from the distance of an immigrant, then you also appreciate the ability to reaffirm your own sense of quote-unquote Frenchness or Italianness or Greekness without that heavy ideological burden that sometimes can be a little bit too limiting.
And unless you are first generation, and I have just a very quick, funny story to tell you. I went to an Italian restaurant here in town the other day, and I was mentioning to the owner, Giancarlo, about another Italian restaurant that I enjoyed. He goes, "That's not Italian." And he had a very thick Italian accent. He goes, "That's not real Italian food." And he went on and on and on. That's because, in my opinion, it so affirms what you're saying. He came from Italy very recently, so he's got the pure sense of what real Italian food is. It might be another region. So it's he was very passionately and very rigorously saying that's not Italian food, which of course it is. It's just not his Italian food.
Yes, in fact, we have a very particular case that was a little bit sad because we have the Diana Kennedy became one of the main promoters, chef of Mexican cuisine. She was just fantastic, wrote amazing books. But she had a real hard time accepting the kinds of foods that Mexican Americans were eating in cities like Los Angeles and San Antonio, you know? And she wrote very sternly advising that was not real Mexican food, of course, because she was deep in the heart of Mexico, appreciating incredible native ingredients and cuisines that just blew her mind. So her position against Mexican-American food out of urban centers like Los Angeles really made her not very well received among that community. And at the same time, here she was occupying, in the Mexican nationalistic sense, a very important role in promoting Mexicanness as an authentic cuisine that had ancient histories and ingredients and just superb and complex. But it was sad because she used language like how much she despised that yellow cheese, you know, melted on beans. But for a lot of people who were eating that, they were working class Mexicanos that had come across the border. So sometimes these things
get... That's what they could eat.
Exactly. Sometimes these things can turn ugly.
And it's another example that highlights what you said earlier about, I mean, Mexican food is a perfect example. There is not one kind. There's Sonoran and there's Chihuahuan. If you go to New Mexico, mm-hmm. it doesn't taste anything, or the choices aren't anything like what you get in some of the Mexican restaurants here. And, you know, I was thinking about it. Salsa is the Mexican version of sausage. Everybody has their own recipe for salsa, and it's mm-hmm. such a strong culture. How their mother made it and how much cilantro and everything got put in it, it's delightful. Okay, so I want to read something from the description of your lecture series, which I thought was eloquent, and maybe you can elaborate on. You're talking about food as one of the most enduring and persuasive symbolic code systems. So I'd like to expand on that. And the quote is, as one of the most enduring and persuasive symbolic code system, food is an object through which humans construct the powerful, and was it imagery or is imagery of belonging, nostalgia, safety, which mm-hmm. I thought was an interesting choice, pleasure and loyalty. So, and there's another part of it, but will you expand a little bit on some of the aspects of that? I don't think about food with safety mm-hmm. anymore, but now there's food safety, there's food security, there's food insecurity. So talk a little bit about the consciousness of food in that context.
Absolutely. In fact, I will be talking about my own parents and my own family's relationship to food as immigrants from Cuba, first immigrants to the United States in the 1950s, then immigrants again, exiles in the 1960s, and how, as a working class family, I'm lucky I have a PhD, now I live the life of a middle class, and perhaps sometimes at times upper middle class professional, but my parents were working class folks. And for them, food and safety were very closely related because it had to do with survival, with the basic, what we have forgotten a lot in this country, which has to do with the basic food basket.
No kidding.
Right? What is it that, what are the staples? So I'm going to be focusing on the role that staples play in the constitution of family. And the very definition of family sometimes, which means who can provide the beans and the rice and the sugar and the milk, right? And the oils that you need to cook. It's amazing to be reminded, for example, through family in Cuba, that without vegetable oil or animal oils, sometimes you're very limited in what you can do with the staples, even that you have been provided
truly
by the government, because you have no way of seasoning them, you have no way of modifying them into the foods that you are used to eating. And for example, that's what would we do without salt?
Really and truly, I have no idea. Yeah,
I want to bring us back in the talk to the basic recognition that while many of us have the privilege of really picking and choosing from a variety of options at Trader Joe's, and we can go sometimes. I know well-off and middle-class professionals who on Saturdays and Sundays when they shop, they go to five different places to shop.
No kidding. We're
because
so
you blessed. You have your Whole Foods stop, and then you have the farmer's market, and then there are some things you get at Trader Joe's. And
you might have to go to Sprouts.
You may have to go to Sprouts, and then occasionally you have to also even go to Safeway because that is the one thing where they carry that mass-produced things that you like. So, but for the working folks, and we have so many people in Tucson who struggle with a basic bottom line of the weekly basket of food. Poverty is very real in this community. And I want to honor my parents in the talk about talking about that role that basic fundamental staples have at the table of working class people who struggle to put food on the table, a phrase that we use a lot. To bring home the bacon, a phrase that we use a lot.
Right.
But that we rarely...
Sometimes there's no bacon.
Sometimes there's no bacon, and sometimes we say, how terrible it is that they're bringing bacon. They should be eating omega-3 oils. Right. What about bringing home the salmon?
That's the right? I never thought of we are what we eat as an admonishment. And I love that you brought that up. So you're right. It's that admonish, you know, you're being admonished in there instead of
recognizing that
we are.
And we start with what we have, you know. We start with what we have. One of the most amazing things that I've learned working with Mexican-American communities and Chicanos and almost now for 30 years is that there's nothing more delicious, absolutely wholesome and amazing than a pot of pinto beans boiling.
I could not agree with you more. And I'm telling you what, this family is saying yes. And to have that, it's right? Oh my gosh, you're right. It is.
Well, that's a staple. That
it's
is
delightful.
Required.
Yeah.
That
yeah,
has to be.
There's always a pot of beans on.
We need to have beans. And think of them not just as that wonderful, oh, healthy food. It's actually staple. It contains all of the cultural meanings, all of the nutritional requirements, and all of the family glue and bonding required to feel like
there's
you belong.
There's just no downside to
and that's just a pot
bowl
of beans.
Yeah. And you know, I'm glad that you brought up that we can't forget. I had Michael McDonald from the Community Food Bank on a couple of shows ago, and it's just so... such a good remembrance that 1 in 3 children in Pima County go to bed hungry. That is not a small number. It's not like we're in the land of milk and honey and plenty for all. Right here in our own backyard, children, 1 in 3. It's 1 in 5 for the state, and for Pima County, it's 1 in 3. And when, you know, you and I could have a whole other show about food waste. We could feed people with the ample harvests that we're throwing in the garbage. I want to ask you for a minute, tying this into what I call the rapidly changing Western culture. And by that, I mean the United States of America. So I was raised very blessed, really very middle class family, struggled. My dad worked, 4 kids. Money was always an issue. We always were fed and clothed. But my mom was a stay-home mom. So our family dinner was sacred. There were no such thing as fast food. We didn't order pizza. My mother cooked. She was a fabulous cook. We all sat down together. No worry about sitting in front of the TV. What's your thought as a visionary and a thought leader? How is this world of the drive-through and kids on their, you know, their iPads and iPods and sitting them in front of the table, how is that going to impact all of our relationship with food? That's a heavy-duty question, but one I'm sure you have some insights.
Well, you know, there is unfortunately a trend to lose some of that fundamental social dividend that food provides for our the well-being of our communities. And there is no doubt, psychologists, sociologists will tell you any day that the kitchen, the hearth, even archaeologists talk about the hearth as that fundamental symbolic space where you learn, how to behave, where you share
traditions
stories.
Traditions are passed on.
Yeah. I mean, we sometimes romanticize those things. I love those Saturday night kids where they had the, you know, the dysfunctional family having dinner at the table, because it always reminds you that, yes, there is that side too. Ideally, those dinner tables were also places for conversation where you really could say what so-and-so said at school today, what, you know.
Do you remember that? I do. I remember having big arguments in my family about political issues, about things that were said at school, about different views.
So there is a sense, no doubt, of loss in that regard. On the other hand, I think sometimes we overstate that loss by failing to recognize that what makes food significant are the human relationships that are built around food.
Okay.
So when I see a mom that is struggling on minimum wage get 5 happy meals for 5 little kids, but she's there eating them with them, and they're together.
I love that
And
answer.
They're laughing. We are missing the point that, of course, there are health implications, and of course that you know, we can demonize McDonald's tomorrow all we want. And of course we can be critical of her judgment, and we can, it can go on and on.
That admonishment again.
Part of the problem that we're never getting beyond our solutions, beyond our problems with these issues of poverty and the issue of class in our society, is because we go first there to that judgment place, as opposed to saying, look at that family. You know, they are eating together. She is providing for them. They are sharing something. And if you think about it, that is really what makes the food in any way meaningful. Otherwise, it's just actual ingredients and caloric content that anybody is just going to put on the table. And if you have a very wealthy family that is eating the best food in the world and following the best etiquette at the table, but they are actually not talking and not loving each other, you end up with more disturbed people than if you have kids on, you know, eating commodity food or foods out of the food bank. So I think we need to revisit sometimes our assumptions, even in the health discourse and in prevalent with local foods and all of that. I'm very weary of how easy we go to that place of judgment.
It's judgment. I love that you keep bringing that up, because it's easy to go there. And, you know, we talk about what I see is, you know, we talked a little bit before we went on air about it can be daunting to look at all the things that I see from guests on a regular basis. But if you look at the hope and possibility, Michael McDonald, what they're doing with the food bank, it's not all about collecting pre-packaged goods filling the pantries. They are doing everything they can to encourage little local gardens, community mm-hmm. gardens, fresh food, food baskets.
Yes.
In every way that they can. So to me, it's part of the explosion of that joy, instead of saying, oh, you know, the food bank just serves processed
Absolutely.
Food.
Absolutely.
It's really a good thing to look at.
I think that with food, we have to remember that our society is very prompt to make of any fad or any item a big social distinction marker. I mean, we have that about blue jeans, you know. You have blue jeans that are for working folks, that were invented for working folks, and then you have blue jeans that cost $500, right?
Yeah, it's so, kind of gross. It is okay. There's judgment on my part.
So with food, we have come to create a culture where we have a lot of conversation about food now, and that is good in many ways. We have food interests, we have food studies, we have food programs, but we also have to remember that that doesn't mean that all of it is good and that all of it is going to be coming out of a place of real building community. So some of that conversation, and some, I know that there's at least a few researchers that call it foodism, you know, that trend of making food some extraordinary thing that makes you feel guilty because you're not in the knowledge, because you're not tasting that amazing flavor that you're supposed to know some strange word for it. All of those things carry with them the same logic of our unequal division of labor, our unequal social system, that all the other possible things we can talk about.
And it's really interesting to me about the what can happen with the human potential, because there is no question that a lot of the new habits of fast food is really contributing to our compromised health system.
Absolutely.
There's no question. However, McDonald's is working on changing, because the public is bringing pressure. So now there's carrots and there's yogurt and there's things without sugar. So the public, all of us, have the power to affect change, not just eat the food. And I've got news for you, kiddo. There are some times when all I want is fast food French fries. You know what I mean? It's like I will be driving and think, this is really what's going to make my body very happy right now. It happens.
Absolutely. There is no doubt about it. And you know, the addiction to Coke, the role of sugar and the poison that it is in terms of our diets. And these things are uncontestable. These are facts that we have to face. But I think that we need to also be thinking about the discourse that is inclusive of our need to feed mass populations of people with convenient and easily accessible food.
And we're just going to have to keep doing that. We have about 1 minute left. I mean, you talk about, it feels like we were in a time warp because it's like here we are with 1 minute left. And I want people to know that I'm quite sure that our guest does not sleep, Maribel Alvarez, because I look at all the things you do, and I wanted to talk to you about what you're doing with Gary Knapan, with the binational food. I mean, you'll come back.
I would love to come back.
Your
it's been a pleasure.
Is Wednesday, October 29th. We Eat What We Are, 6:30 at the Fox Theater. Check it out at downtownlectureseries.arizona.edu. Thanks for showing up in
Mrs. Green's world
and for the planet. Make it a great green day, everybody, and make sure you get down to the Fox. Thanks.